Policy Committee. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm glad you're with us today. First of all, I'm going to ask members to unmute your feeds and then raise your hand if you would like to ask a question. I think everybody's probably getting used to this at this time. We do have a quorum present, so we will begin the hearing. And first of all, we have minutes from January 11th that were sent out with our packet. Does anyone want to move the minutes? Representative Hewitt, can you move the minutes of the January 11th hearing?
Madam Chair, I move the minutes for that date.
All right. Are there any discussion to the minutes? Okay, seeing none, if you would just unmute yourselves to vote orally. All those in favor of the minutes of January 11th, please say aye.
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 Okay, thank you. The minutes are approved. With that, members, we're going to go to an overview from the Department of Health. And I see that we have Commissioner Malcolm. So I'm going to stop talking. Oh, I see that I think Representative Ackland has her hand up. Representative Ackland.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
There's my video. Your voice is cutting in and out, and I can barely understand or hear you. Sorry about that.
Okay, thanks for letting me know that. I'm not going to be doing most of the talking. I'll try to fix it while Commissioner Malcolm is talking. Thank you. Commissioner Malcolm, you're on. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I think you said you wanted me to begin, so I will do that. Good afternoon, members of the committee. Jan Malcolm, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health. It's nice to be with you, even virtually, and embarking on this next plate of session. So very much look forward to working with you all session long. What we're intending here today is kind of a very general, high-level overview of what we do at the Minnesota Department of Health in more normal times, as well as a little bit of discussion about COVID. But I really personally appreciate a chance to talk about other things about public health, even though for us since about the end of last January, it's been pretty much all COVID all the time. This is a great chance to orient the committee to the broader mission and work of the department. At the Minnesota Department of Health, we have a mission that is very meaningful to all of us, to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans, no small thing. And really the emphasis on all Minnesotans for many years has compelled us to look deeply at issues of health equity and health inequity and what are the things that really produce such different outcomes for people in our state, depending on a number of things. This next slide is perhaps, you know, one of the most important slides in the most important kind of frameworks or perspectives in health policy in recent years. And that is really sharper and sharper understanding of what it is that really determines the health of populations of people, individuals to be sure, but really when you take that broader look at comparing groups of people, What is it that determines how healthy they are at the end of the day? And what's let me just say at the outset, this is an artificially tidy pie chart. Of course, things aren't quite this clear and distinct. All of these factors interact with each other, and many issues fall into more than one category, of course. But the kind of stunning thing here, when you're looking at comparing the health across populations, only 10% of the difference in health outcomes is really attributable to differences in access to clinical medical care, which is kind of a, you know, not kind of, it is a counterintuitive finding that medical care itself is 10% of what determines how healthy we are. We've known for a long time, of course, that that health behaviors are very, very important. What the decisions we individually make about our diet, exercise, other risk behaviors that we engage in. And we know that's a very large determinant of health, especially when combined with genes and biology, which we know is also an important determinant of how healthy we are individually and collectively. We know that the physical environment matters a lot. The quality of the air, the water, the circumstances of the built environment around us, how much room is there for exercise, what kind of transportation system do we have? Many decisions about how we construct our communities impacts our health pretty directly and clearly. The single largest determinant or group of determinants of health of populations are social and economic factors. And that has to do with things like education, employment, income, housing, family circumstances, and the sort of the construct of society. And that's really where this comes from is literally decades of research, of health services research, looking at comparing groups of people and what accounts for the differences in their health. And these data have just become more and more quantified, more and more clear, more and more based in hard science and literature over the intervening years. And just to explain this one a little bit more, when you start to think about it, it makes a lot of sense. These social and economic factors influence everything else on the chart. It clearly, the social and economic conditions in a community determine how much healthcare there is in that community. Is it a place where clinics are located? It determines the physical environment, how much investment is there in the infrastructure in a community. And very powerfully, it influences health behaviors. People don't make choices in a vacuum. They make choices based on what's realistically available to them as options in their lives and choices that they can make about things like nutrition and employment and education and exercise. So this is just a really fundamental part of the way we in public health view our work and view where are the opportunities to improve health for our communities. Absolutely, clinical care is critical. I don't in any way mean to diminish the importance of clinical care. It is to say that the best clinical care in the world cannot override the importance of all these other variables on what is driving health problems to begin with, or how do we make our people healthier if we don't pay attention to all these other factors that actually have a far more powerful impact on outcomes than just whether we can get to the doctor when we need to, as absolutely essential as that is. Next slide, please. This is a chart. This is several years old now. I have not gone searching for an updated picture here, but the basics haven't changed. This is kind of a comparison of the top industrialized countries in the world and what they spend as a proportion of their economy on medical care versus public health and other social services, human services, those other determinants of health that we just looked at on that chart. And this is really pretty interesting. It starts to explain how it is that the United States spends way more money on healthcare than other countries and doesn't get the same kind of results when it comes to population health outcomes. You can see here that as a combined total of medical care and other public health and social services, the United States is not a top spender. We're among the lower spending countries, but the ratio of our spending on medical care versus public health and other social services is literally the reverse of most of the other countries. So it just simply reflects either an implicit or an explicit choice in the policy strategies of the various countries on how they're balancing their investments in medical care versus those other determinants of health. Next slide, please. Here in the United States, this picture shows how the United States distributes its resources across medical care and public health, meaning individual medical care versus investments that are aimed not at individuals, but at broader community health strategies. And you can see there that about 5% of the total national spending on health is related to prevention or medical or public health measures of a broader nature than individual medical care interventions. Here in Minnesota, this is the Health and Human Services Committee, and just as a matter of proportion in terms of the state budget distribution, MDH, the Prevention and Public Health Agency, is about 3% of the total of the combined Health and Human Services budget. So DHS is just vastly larger than MDH in terms of budget, which is sort of in line with sort of the United States general approach to investment in medical care versus public health. Next slide, please. Ellen, this is a huge oversimplification. I saw my friend and colleague, Commissioner Harpstead, on the call here, or on the meeting, and I know she will be talking about DHS at another time. But just as we know, we work with counties and local governments all the time, and oftentimes people really don't have a hard time understanding what is the difference between the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health. You guys both work on healthcare stuff. What's the difference? Generally, and again, huge oversimplification here. DHS is the major funder of medical care services to large parts of our population, and is involved in providing, financing, assuring that people can get treatment when they need it for problems. Versus the public health approach at MDH is much more about trying to prevent the problems to begin with. Again, DHS also does a lot in the realm of prevention. But from a budgetary standpoint, DHS is investing in trying to assist problems that exist, and MDH is investing in trying to work upstream, as we say, to try to prevent health problems from the beginning. So whereas DHS would be funding medical treatment, for various childhood illnesses, for example, MDH's programming would be about encouraging childhood immunizations. DHS pays for a lot of chronic disease treatment. About 80% of all the money spent on healthcare is spent to treat chronic diseases, whereas at MDH, our programming is really focused on working with a broad set of partners, certainly local public health, but also the healthcare community, providers, health plans, community-based organizations, and the like, to try to reduce the prevalence of chronic disease through prevention strategies. DHS obviously is a major leader in the state on treating people with addiction or overdoses, whereas our work in MDH, and again, in partnership with DHS in many cases, is to try to not only assist with making sure people can get access to the services that they need, but always seeking to go further and further upstream and understanding what is at the root of the problems that lead to addiction or overdose to begin with, that show up in a number of negative health indicators. Next slide, please. One of the things we certainly know is that Minnesota is a healthy state on average, but that's the problem. It's on average. And underneath that average, we have some of the worst health disparities in the nation, and that's been true literally for decades. And it's a double whammy, quite honestly. This is not only true comparing the populations of color and indigenous communities in Minnesota with the white population. It's also true comparing our populations of color and indigenous people with their peers in other states. So not only are populations of color less healthy than whites in Minnesota, they are less healthy than populations of color in other states in many cases, which is a real conundrum for us in Minnesota. And that manifests in shorter lifespans overall, higher rates of infant mortality, higher rates on a number of diseases, and poorer general health. So working to address health disparities, health inequities, as we call them, it's not just a difference, it's a difference caused by structural barriers to health faced by some of our communities. And that is a major part of our vision for a healthier Minnesota and a state of health equity in Minnesota. Next slide, please. This is just sort of a question about why the poor performance. And by performance here, we're talking about why are we getting relatively little bang for the buck, if you will, when we consider our health spending versus our health outcomes. And again, we looked at chronic disease as a good indicator of the health system's performance here. We know we've got a very significant part of our population, for example, with one major risk factor, obesity. About 25% of the age 10 to 64 population was clinically, moderately, or severely obese in 2017, and with direct medical spending for those conditions of $476 million every year. In addition, 900,000 adults over the age of 60 have at least one diagnosed chronic disease at a cost of $9.4 billion a year. And these data come out of our all-payer claims database at the Health Department and various health economics analyses. 37% of adults were exposed to smoking in 2014. That's a combination of current smokers, those exposed to secondhand smoke, or have recently quit. This is down from 40% in 2009, reflecting, you know, continued incremental progress in reducing the burden of tobacco on our society, but still costs $250 million a year in direct medical costs. So these are big numbers, and the trends here, with the exception of tobacco use, which has plateaued, hasn't materially improved in recent years. And of course, more recently, we've got the new, relatively new phenomenon of vaping and the risks that is now posing to our youth. But these are large numbers, and they're on a path to increase by significant amounts. Next slide. Our health economics division does projections of what's going to happen to the cost of healthcare overall and what's attributable to chronic conditions. And that those numbers are just on a path to just continue to grow by phenomenal proportions, even as challenged as we are today with the cost of healthcare, given what's in the pipeline in terms of chronic disease progression for our population. We see these projections of further increases of up to $15 billion each year for increases in chronic conditions among those over 60. Dementia-related care is also going up at a very rapid clip. Hypertension-related spending, just as one particular chronic condition alone, is projected to increase up to $7.7 billion a year for that one condition. So the moral of this story is with this amount of chronic disease building in our population, we can't afford to just treat our way out of the problem, or the current budget is just going to continue to eat up the rest of the capacity for state spending. Next slide, please. So that's really sort of a background on, you know, why it is that we do what we do. Why are we trying to take this prevention focus to look holistically at what are the causes of poor health, and what can we do to get upstream to try to change some of these trends in the most fundamental way? So I'm going to talk just for a few minutes about how we're organized at the health department. And with me on the call are the assistant commissioners that lead each of these bureaus. The Health Operations Bureau is the home of our financial management folks, our human resources, facilities management, and information technology, as well as a number of other kind of support functions that support the programmatic operations of the entire agency. And the Health Operations Bureau is headed by the agency's deputy commissioner and current chief operating officer, Margaret Kelly. The next bureau is called the Health Protection Bureau. And this is the home to the Environmental Health Division, the Public Health Laboratory, and the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division. And this group has been much in the center of the COVID response this year, of course. But I'll also mention, just as we're on this point, while this, the core business of this bureau has a lot to do with understanding and controlling health risks of a wide variety of kinds, and particularly of risks to health that arise from infectious agents or environmental causes. This year, over 70% of the entire agency's workforce has been redeployed to work with this bureau on COVID response. So in the subsequent slides, you're going to see the work that we typically do in our other bureaus of the agency, but the majority of the folks charged with doing that work have actually been deployed in whole or in part to assisting with the COVID response. So the Health Protection Bureau, with these three large divisions, is headed by Assistant Commissioner Dan Huff. Next slide, please. The next bureau is the Health Improvement Bureau, which is where a lot of the core prevention work happens. And we have three divisions here: the Child and Family Health Division, Health Promotion and Chronic Disease Division, and the Community Health Division. I'm going to come back and describe each of these major divisions in just a moment here, but just trying to orient you to how they're grouped together in the agency. The Health Improvement Bureau is headed by Assistant Commissioner Mary Manning. And the last programmatic bureau, is called the Health Systems Bureau. And this is where our Health Policy Division, our Health Regulation Division, which is where we work with long-term care and medical providers, and the Office of Medical Cannabis. So the three divisions in that bureau, which is headed by Assistant Commissioner Diane Reigrich. Next slide, please. This slide, and it's hard to read and not meant to go through in detail here, but this is our proposed 2021 policy agenda, which is very focused. Frankly, I think almost all of it are carryovers from last legislative session, which was so very changed and disrupted by the emergence of COVID during the last session. But these are pretty focused proposals aimed at cleaning up a few things, making some operational improvements that are important and that have been worked on for a while. And we certainly, Madam Chair, can come back to talking about those policy bills at a later time, or come back to them in your questions today. Next slide, please. So the next few, we'll talk through the work of each of the major divisions and how that work conforms to how the health department's budget is organized. The next slide, please. So this is a story of the agency overall, the total expenditures for the agency over the last several biennia and projected out into the next couple of biennia. And you can see that it's a pretty steady state budget, except for what happened in fiscal 2021. With the near doubling of the agency in terms of the resources that have been brought to bear for the COVID epidemic from both federal and state sources. But that is projected to ramp down in the next biennium and then return to its more normal levels in the out biennium. So that is total expenditure and outlays for the agency as a whole. Next slide, please. And how that's broken down, and again, this is impacted significantly by COVID funding, but this pattern generally is the pattern that we see. The largest source of funding for MDH, not just in COVID years, but normal years, is federal funding. I think this next biennium has a larger share than usual of general funds due to state investments in COVID response. So federal funds, general fund, medical education fund, which is a separate a dedicated fund in the budget, licenses and fees from regulated entities in health regulation and environmental health for the most part, other state funds, and the healthcare access fund, which is funded by the provider tax, which funds a number of things in the Health Policy Division, as well as the statewide health improvement program, the statewide prevention strategy that's aimed at some of the largest risk factors that drive chronic conditions. Next slide, please. And that, by the way, that prior slide, if you just go back one, sorry, those are sources of funds for the for the next biennium that is projected. Next slide. This one is a retrospective look at the end of fiscal 2020, where our staff were funded from. We have just over 1,500 full-time equivalent staff. This is a heavily technical staff of mainly scientific and programmatic experts who range from physicians, epidemiologists, nurses, economists, data analysts, to community health specialists, engineers, laboratorians, as well as, of course, a number of support functions, communications, HR, finance, and the like. The staff are funded, again, significantly, and this is also due to the uptick in federal funds from last year. 39% of the staff paid for by federal sources, 24% by fees. Only 11% of the agency's staff is funded by general fund appropriations, and 6% by other sources like the Access Fund. Next slide, please. This is the coming biennium and our what we know of federal awards in fiscal 22 and 23. And again, this represents an unusual bolus of funds for the COVID response. Typically, the largest single source, programmatically, the largest source at the Health Department is funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the WIC program. Financially, the largest program in the agency, typically. You can just see there, you know, small share coming from Environmental Protection Agency for environmental health, agriculture for WIC, and then a number of different parts of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Agency for Children's and Families, Children and Families, CDC, of course, historically our largest federal funder and significantly larger this year with all the COVID work. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services funds a lot of our Health Regulation Division work. Health Resources and Services Administration funds much of what we do in our work that directly supports health providers. And then some special program kind of funding out of the Secretary's office and other agencies, and then a variety of other federal departments. So that the main takeaway there are HRSA, CMS, CDC, and the WIC program are our largest federal funders. Next slide, please. And this is what we spend the money on. And this is historically about the same pattern. This is for next biennium, but this really conforms with what our historical norms are as well. About half of the agency's total budget is distributed by the department out to grants, aids, and subsidies to local public health, to healthcare providers through a variety of programmatic areas and community-based organizations, with about a quarter of the budget on employee compensation and a little over a quarter of the budget on operating expenses, which would include things like the laboratory, IT, communications, HR, and the like. Next slide, please. So now I'm gonna go into projected spending by each of the major program areas, the major divisions that we talked about. And these are, I will say, organized a little bit differently from the budget perspective than they are from the agency organization chart. So health improvement, health protection, and health operations on this slide. And you can see there that the health improvement, and here's where this is an unusual year in terms of how staff are redeployed to the COVID response. So a whole lot of the folks in the Health Improvement Bureau that are working in these divisions have been reassigned to COVID response, which is where a lot of the funding is coming from this year. So this is an unusual division here of spending by program. And Assistant Commissioner Kelly, Deputy Commissioner Kelly, excuse me, can comment further on some of these slides as we get into questions. So this is just kind of breaks down what the how staff are actually allocated this year as opposed to what their kind of historical pending spending pattern is. Next slide, please. And here this just shows it another way, that that child and family health and community health are much larger as sources of the budget than they typically would be because of their reallocation to the COVID response in this year, and it's also true of health policy. So this is just sort of where the people are housed in the agency that are working on COVID response and their other normal duties as well. Next slide. So this is now kind of a walk through the major divisions of the agency, and I'll spend just a little bit more time here. This is our chance to tell you about the broader work of the agency as well as what we're doing this year on COVID. So in child and family health, again, this is where the Women, Infant, and Children program is, the nutrition supports, but a whole range of other work to improve maternal and child health. And what some of the key statistics that we track here, progress in infant mortality over the last decades, but big concerns with health inequities in infant mortality and maternal mortality as well, I should say. Teen pregnancies have come down very significantly in the last 18 years. We have more caregivers who have completed high school or GED education, supported by the work of this division. This program, as mentioned, provides nutrition support for over 162,000 women, infants, and young children each year, and home visiting services for 14,000 at-risk families, which is one of the really significant evidence-based public health interventions to try to produce better long-term outcomes for families and children. And supporting 35 services for 35,000 children with special health needs in their families. But that is the work of the Child and Family Health Division. Next slide, please. The Health Promotion Division, which again is where a lot of the chronic disease work, both tracking, working with health providers on best practices and communities on prevention, happens in the Health Promotion Division. Some of the key statistics here, over 10,000 low-income women are screened each year for breast and or cervical cancer. 35,600 new cancer cases were registered with the statewide cancer reporting system in the last year, for which we have complete data. Over almost 25,000 Minnesotans with traumatic brain or spinal cord injuries were served in the violence and injury prevention section in 2019. We've got over almost 26,000 Minnesotans enrolled in a highly evidence-based diabetes prevention program through the Health Promotion Division. And this is also the home for the funding for the state's poison control system, which is a highly effective resource to help prevent, certainly to save lives, but also to prevent trips to the emergency room whenever possible by providing poison control information over the phone. Next slide, please. The Community Health Division. This is the locus of our relationship with local public health, our key partners in actually delivering much of the work of public health on the ground in our local communities. So the Community Health Division supports our 51 community health boards, which are statutorily charged local units of government, either counties or multi-county joint powers agreement health boards, to do the work of local public health under the coordination and direction of the state health department. This division also oversees emergency preparedness work and a large grant program to eliminate health disparities. And that health disparities work goes back to 2001, actually, with one of the first eliminating health disparities initiatives in the nation, which continues to this day and has evolved and grown over time. And especially this year, we're obviously very much seeing the need for and the importance of emergency preparedness and response, and having coordinated activities between the state health department, those local public health agencies, and 8 regional healthcare preparedness coalitions, which link the healthcare systems, long-term care, and local public health in each of 8 regions to do planning. And this year, that mission has expanded beyond planning and into helping with implementation of various aspects of the COVID response. The Community Health Division also is home to the health statistics area, which collects and analyzes and communicates health-related data. Next slide, please. The Health Policy Division houses a lot of our work with healthcare providers, as well as the generation of health economics analysis and technical assistance and advice to the legislature on various health policy considerations. In Minnesota, we've had our healthcare home program for probably about a decade now, and we work with, certify, and train 400 healthcare homes statewide, which collectively are serving 3.5 million people through healthcare homes. Some recent analysis attributes that strategy to savings of more than $1 billion in healthcare costs through better coordination of care and better focus on primary care and prevention over the past 5 years. The Health Policy Division also has the state registrar and issues more than 750,000 birth and death certificates each year. This division also works on electronic health data strategies with our provider community. And as mentioned, does a lot of work of general and specific technical assistance work with the legislature on health policy matters, as well as administering significant grant and loan forgiveness programs to support provider training and provider retention in rural and underserved communities in specific. Next slide, please. In the Medical Cannabis Division, is one of our smaller parts of the agency in terms of budget and also staff, was created to stand up the medical cannabis program in Minnesota, which has grown from its inception in 2016 to now serving almost 18,000 enrolled people who have been enrolled in the program cumulatively, currently in 2020. And we've now got almost 1,800 healthcare practitioners participating in the program who are authorized to certify patients for participation as of last August. The program, this division oversees the 2 manufacturers and 16 cannabis patient centers in Minnesota. We each year we receive petitions from providers and the public as to what conditions should be considered for inclusion in the medical cannabis program. Our most recent addition to the qualifying conditions was chronic pain, which was added in August of 2020. And the next major division, kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of size of division, if cannabis was our smallest program, environmental health and the health regulation division are 2 of our largest. The environmental health division works on all things water related, as well as other aspects of tracking risk levels in various aspects of the environment. So a couple, and they're primarily fee funded, as you can see here. A couple of the key metrics that are tracked here is the quality of the drinking water supply and the relationship with public water operators to keep that water supply safe, more than 7,000 public water systems. Also ensuring the safety of food and drinking water, in restaurant lodging establishments and swimming pools in over 24,000 regulated establishments statewide. As another example of a specific program working on reducing indoor radiation exposure for over 11,000 facilities and individual contractors, and certifying 12,000 food managers each year and supporting 36,000 active food managers to help keep the food supply safe throughout the state. Also, we regulate annually the installation of 6,000 new wells and the sealing of 7,000 wells, which are no longer in use. So a broad variety of activities there. And the Infectious Disease Epidemiology Prevention and Control Division, or IDEPC, you will hear it often referred to, is very much in the spotlight this year with all the work that they are doing to track and assist with strategies to mitigate and manage this spread of this global pandemic, COVID-19. They are responsible for tracking and following up on the positive cases, analyzing the epidemiology, collecting the data, posting it daily on what's happening with testing, positive cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. The 24/7 disease detection system has been put to enormous use this year. We have reporting requirements that providers are required to report to us when certain things emerge, and then we do the case investigation, contact tracing, and control strategies to try to help control outbreaks of infectious disease, such as coronavirus, pandemic influenza annually, and recent infectious agents such as Ebola and Zika in prior years. H1N1, also a fairly recent experience with a novel infectious agent. This same division coordinates regular childhood immunization programs, 70,000 infants born each year who are part of that childhood immunization program. The department and this division is recognized as one of the finest groups of epidemiologists and infectious disease experts in the country. And a recent success was to investigate and really contain the largest multi-drug resistant tuberculosis outbreak in the country several years back within Ramsey County in close partnership with our local public health agency there. And just as another interesting data note, sexually transmitted illnesses are still much with us and remain of key public health concern in the state. Another part of this division.
Commissioner, can you hear me?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay, good. I've been having audio problems and I thought I wasn't going to be able to get in here at all. I'm going to need to get you to finish up because we also do have Commissioner Harpstead, and I wanted to give folks a few minutes. How much do you have left here?
Not very much. I'll definitely do that. And my apologies, Madam Chair, I didn't realize you had more on your agenda today. So I will speed it up here.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. The Public Health Laboratory, again, cannot say enough about their work this year. They have done enormous things. They've worked far beyond their normal scope they were the first ones doing COVID testing in the state and have continued to just do incredible science. They're always continually scanning for new risks to health in infectious disease in the environment. And you can just see there some of the metrics of the screening that they have done, not only for viral illnesses, including COVID, but the newborn screening program is a particular point of pride for the lab as well. Significantly fee funded as well, and mostly fees and federal funding there. And the next slide is health regulation. We talk a lot about that in Chair Schultz's committee. This is where we work with long-term care facilities and providers to oversee many things related to the regulation of those facilities. As well, the Health Regulation Division has responsibility for certain aspects of health maintenance organization regulation, particularly around network adequacy and quality, and a number of, and we also regulate funeral establishments and maintain a number of supportive programs like spoken language interpreters. Sorry to be rushing through that, but I think that, and then the final, I think, is the health operations division, which provides so much of our critical just operational capacity to support the department overall through our 10 offices around the state, human resources, IT, financial management, as well as supporting the production of a lot of the data production and report generation, as well as the communications function of the agency. And that concludes. I think our concluding slide is a bit ironic. You know, we always talk about how public health is, for the most part, invisible. And the better we are at what we do, the more invisible we are. Well, this year, public health has not been invisible. But I think it speaks to the ongoing importance of making prevention a larger part of our strategies going forward. And Madam Chair, I know that was a rapid speed, but still lengthy description of the health department, but appreciate the opportunity to give you, your committee, an overview of all that goes on at the state health department. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Commissioner. I really appreciate it. And, you know, it's really important for members to understand that the health department does cover all these different issues. I do have a couple questions for members, and I will call on them, but I just would like to say to members, this is an overview. I know that we probably have a lot of COVID-related issues that we'd all like to raise with the commissioner, and this really isn't the time to do that. We will have other hearings in which we will take those kinds of questions, but I would really like to ask you right now to confine your questions to sort of more organizational questions. And we just have a very few minutes for that because I know that Commissioner Harpstead is also waiting to give us an overview. So let's take a few right now for Commissioner Malcolm, and then we'll go to Commissioner Harpstead. So Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Two quick questions. On your slide presentation, Commissioner Malcolm, by the way, Commissioner, thank you for what you do, and thank you for the presentation. I know it's a huge budget out there, so. But use of all funds, okay, I don't know if you're, it doesn't have a page number on it, but it's use of all funds fiscal year 22 and 23. You know, it's grants, aids, and subsidies, employee compensation, operating expenses. You know, normally.
Do you even look at the tickets?
Pardon? Okay, normally, Commissioner Malcolm, I'm in the insurance business for a lot of years, and we're looking at 10% or less of operating and employee compensation as a percent of a particular program or insurance program. In fact, in the state of Minnesota, last time I checked, I think 90 cents of every health insurance dollar on the individual market has to go back to doctors and hospitals. And when I look at this, and again, it's just an initial, and maybe I'm misinterpreting something, but we have 24% of the program going to employee compensation and 27%. So we got over half the money going for operating expenses and employee compensation. Then you look at grants, aids, and subsidies, and you know it's 49%. And I'm sure some of the grants and subsidies that go out, those people are also getting, you know, paid or salary and benefits. So it seems like a very large percentage of the funds go for operating expenses and employee compensation versus for the actual program. Or am I missing something here? Okay, it's just an initial thought.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, yeah, thank you for allowing us to clarify here. I think that the operating expenses and the employees are programmatic investments. It's not at all just overhead. These are the scientists doing the laboratory analyses, the environmental health, the infectious disease prevention and control. So that those are programmatic activities. They're not just administrative costs.
Okay.
Good question, Representative Grunhagen. Did you have another quick question?
Yeah, a quick question. you know, just I know there's that issue of healthcare disparities. And I, again, I haven't done a scientific study. I just checked with some people locally who work in the healthcare industry who want to remain anonymous for whatever reason. But they, you know, one of the things I ask them is it the low reimbursement rate that people are on Medicaid that contributes to kind of a widget-making healthcare system, because the doctors and hospitals are losing money on the reimbursement. And so are they pushing these people through faster? You know, you lose money on every deal, you make it up in volume. Is that contributing, not necessarily based on ethnic group, but on the fact that the government reimbursement programs are so low, it's like they push them through pretty quickly because of the losses they obtain. Can you make a comment about that?
Representative Gernhagen, I don't know that that's necessarily the right question for Commissioner Malcolm. I guess what I would say is that sounds like, I mean, certainly let her answer if she chooses to. She looks like she wants to say something, but I just would say for members, this sounds like a much larger discussion that we should perhaps have at another time as well. But go ahead, Commissioner Malcolm.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Gernhagen. I would love the opportunity to talk in greater depth with my colleague, Commissioner Harpstead, about health disparities and the many ways that we understand what's producing them and what we can do about it. Certainly, access to health care and the quality of that health care is critical and is a significant focus of DHS and MDH when it comes to studying health outcomes. But definitely, I think the picture of what produces and what we need to do about health inequities is a great topic for a broader discussion.
So you don't think low reimbursement aggravates the situation?
I wouldn't know how to quantify the impact that that it has, but certainly access to healthcare and the role of reimbursement are important things to track. But Commissioner Harpstead might have a perspective on that.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Gernhagen. I'm sure we'll be talking about that quite a bit this session. Representative Quam and then Morrison.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Glenn and the other members of the committee, some of the slides that have the disaggregation of race versus program SNAP, MFIP, et cetera, might be able to lead some insight into what Glenn was curious about. But my questions are more in the public health and many of the areas, you know, hypertension, dementia, you know, et cetera, where you're indicating there's a great increase in projected expenditures. If there are data available of percent of population or numbers that have each of these conditions, and then maybe annual mortality, and just add into the same pot maybe a percent of comorbidity with, you know, the current pandemic issues, so that way we can see, get a better feel for those health, public health type issues. So, you know, more data to go with the bullet points that were presented in the slides. Thank you.
Sure.
Madam Chair and Representative Quam, thank you. We'd love to do a deeper data dive on chronic conditions and demography and disaggregating the data to point out where the greatest pressures and opportunities are. Thank you.
And Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for your presentation. Boy, the take-home to me is we need to really change our priorities and invest much more in preventative health and in the social determinants of health. I think that was pretty clear from your presentation and from the numbers that you presented. Mostly, I just want to take this opportunity to publicly thank you for your work for the people of the state of Minnesota over this past year. I might get emotional. We are so very lucky to have you in the position that you are. So thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Morrison. I totally echo that. And since my audio hasn't been functioning for a lot of this hearing, I haven't been able to say a lot, but I do want to just, you know, I hope people realize that MDH is a really a pretty small agency as it goes, and it's been really had this enormous responsibility that it's had to pick up during this time of COVID. And I think it's really, I think of it as the little agency that could, if you know that kid's book. Yeah, I think the commissioner is doing a fantastic job. You know, not to say that there aren't good questions that we can ask and concerns that we might all have, that that's always going to be the case, but this is just unknown, uncharted territory. And we did not have the structures in place when this thing began. I'm not sure we totally have them in place now, but we are certainly a lot better off than we were at the beginning. So thank you so much, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Representative Morrison and members of the committee, thank you. The people in MDH and local public health are also among the healthcare heroes or the health heroes in this pandemic. So thank you for that recognition.
Thank you. So we will go now to Commissioner Harpstead. Welcome to the committee. And Commissioner Harpstead will talk to us about the Department of Human Services. And I should just all give you my the other little thing I like to say when we hear about these presentations at the beginning of a new session is that when we look at the two agencies that tend to come before this committee, Health and Human Services, we see one commissioner, we see the other commissioner. There's a tendency to think that they're kind of equivalent in size, and they are so not equivalent in size. And I think of it like the sun and the moon, where you look up in the sky and they look like they're not that different. And in fact, they're hugely different. So I just like to give that context at the beginning. And so the enormous agency is under the very capable leadership of Commissioner Harpstead, and welcome.
Thank you so much. And before I start, before she zips off of this call, I just wanted to give a shout out as well to my colleague, Commissioner Malcolm. Yes, it's true, the Department of Human Services is much, much bigger than the Department of Health. And we are proud to currently have 221 people redeployed outside of the department, supporting our colleagues in the Department of Health in the brilliant work that they've done to keep Minnesotans safe and healthy through this pandemic year. So we're very proud to walk side by side with them through this effort. So Chairman Liebling and members, welcome to those of you who are new to the committee. Welcome everyone to 2021, which we all hope will be a year of greater possibility and opportunity for all Minnesotans than 2020. I'm Jody Harpstead, Commissioner of the Department of Human Services. Our mission is working with many others. We help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. We are the largest state agency in Minnesota with approximately 7,000 plus employees at 200 plus sites. We have six major administrations. Our healthcare administration, we administer the state's Medicaid insurance plan, continuing care for older adults, community supports, primarily persons with disabilities and behavioral health. We have direct care and treatment services across the state. We fund and regulate children and family services, and then we have our own operations staff. This is another way to look at it. If you look at the blue bars, you will see how our budget breaks out, with 81% of our budget, $14 billion, going to pay for Minnesota's healthcare programs. And then the green bars, you can see that 85% of our employees are actually in our direct care and treatment services across the state of Minnesota. So depending on whether you're talking about how many people we have or how much money gets spent, the picture is very, very different. This is our organization chart, and just briefly, I want to point out that on the left side here, you can see our Deputy Commissioner, Chuck Johnson, who's been with the department for decades and very capable, and has all of our control functions, our finance, compliance, HR, IT functions, for example, and our direct care and treatment services under the capable leadership of Marshall Smith also report to Chuck Johnson. On the right side, we have our brand new interim deputy commissioner, Nikki Farrago, who manages communications and relations.
And then down the center, we have our other assistant commissioners of our various administrations, children and families, community supports, continuing care for older adults, and healthcare. And I have three other direct reports, our chief of staff, our equity officer, and general counsel. We serve children and families, people with disabilities, and older Minnesotans. Some people say that almost everyone in Minnesota comes into contact with us at some point in their lives. But I want to make clear, if you're not familiar with us, that first of all, most of the work that we do are services that we fund and regulate. And that's our healthcare coverage, economic assistance, food support, child protection, child welfare and support, care for older adults, services for people with disabilities, mental illness, substance use disorder, services to support people experiencing homelessness. And then we have our licensing division and direct service for people who are deaf or hard of hearing. So these are the services we fund and regulate. And then in our direct care and treatment, these are services we actually provide. Our forensic security hospital in St. Peter, residential services for people with disabilities, specialty dental care, intensive mental health treatment, substance use disorder, residential treatment, and sex offender treatment. And I would add here that what we have here in direct care and treatment at DHS is a behavioral health system, which is approximately the same size as the CentraCare system in central Minnesota, if you have sort of a handle on how big that is. Our general direction in our direct care and treatment services is to support those people that other providers cannot or will not serve because of their intense needs. Minnesota, as a state, excels in human services. We were just once again ranked first in the nation in long-term services and supports for older adults. We've often been ranked nationally number one in services for people with disabilities. In 2020, the Annie E. Casey Foundation named us third nationally in child well-being. The Commonwealth Fund in 2019 called us third nationally in healthcare access, quality, and outcomes. And we are seventh nationally for overall health, according to America's Health Rankings from 2019. And just as Commissioner Malcolm said, that leads us directly to the next slide, which while we excel in human services, we have a great disparity in outcomes. People of color three times as likely to live in poverty compared to whites. American Indian, Alaska Native, Black, African American, Hispanic, Latino patients, significantly lower rates of optimal care. 6.8 of every 10,000 people of color experience homelessness compared with 68 of every 10,000 people of color compared with 6.2 of 10,000 white folk. American Indian children and children of color significantly more likely to be in out-of-home placement than white children. We are working hard to change that statistic. And a higher incidence of low birth weight babies for mothers who are Black, African American, Asian Pacific Islander, or American Indian. This is a busy chart that I've been showing to the governor recently in morning briefings about COVID. It's the people who are currently enrolling in our public health programs, our SNAP food benefit, and our MFIT program to support working parents. If you start at the bottom, you can see on the first, on the left side, blue chart, the way people enrolled in our healthcare, our public healthcare programs during the Great Recession. And you can see that this number of months into the Great Recession, 3%, there was a 3% growth in enrollment in our health programs. And so far in the first 9 months of COVID, there's an 8% growth in enrollment in our health programs. These charts are also on the same absolute scale. So you can see that our health programs during COVID are much bigger, taller than they were in the Great Recession. And that's the addition of what we call the Medicaid expansion program that came along with the Affordable Care Act, which is why our healthcare programs are much bigger than they were back in the Great Recession. On the bottom right, you can see our SNAP programs. That's our food support benefit. And you can see how they grew 5% in the first 9 months of the Great Recession, and that program's grown 6% in the first 9 months of COVID. And then at the top, you see our MFIT program support for working parents. And here, the this benefit grew 2% in the first 9 months of the Great Recession and has grown 15% in the first 9 months of COVID. These maps show you geographically how our enrollees are dispersed. If you look at the green and blue boxes at the bottom, you can see, first of all, the population of Minnesota is 55% in the 7-county metro area and 45% in greater Minnesota. And the distribution of our public health programs is almost exactly the same. When it comes to SNAP, there's a slight difference with a little bit more in the metro area than greater Minnesota. And when it comes to MFIP, it's a tiny bit more, again, in the metro than in greater Minnesota. And I just want to point out those two white counties at the bottom are not zero enrollments in our programs. That's the combined Dodge, Steele, Waseca counties. And the data is consolidated in the Center County, Steele County for purposes of the map. Here you see the age distribution. First of all, this first bar at the top is the age distribution of Minnesotans. 23% of Minnesotans are children under the age of 18, 61% in the middle years, and 16% seniors. Our public health programs are more skewed toward children than adults. Our SNAP program is 2, and MFIP as well. 39% of Minnesota's children are in our public health programs. 14% of Minnesota's children are in our SNAP programs, and 5% of Minnesota's children are in our MFIP program. This shows the racial disaggregation of our services. Somebody mentioned this earlier. At the top, again, you can see the distribution of Minnesotans by race. On the next bar, you can see the distribution of people enrolled in our health plans by race. And unfortunately, the way people enroll today in our health plans, there's this large red bar at the right, which is unknown because the race question for enrollment in health plans has become optional and more people don't fill it in. On our SNAP programs, you can see the racial disaggregation and then at the bottom in MFIP. And just to take a look at MFIP, for example, the Latinx population is enrolled in MFIP at 2 times their proportion of the state of Minnesota. The Black population is enrolled in MFIP at 5 times their proportion of the state of Minnesota. And the American Indian population is enrolled in MFIP at 9 times their proportion of the state of Minnesota. On the other end of the spectrum, you can see some of our programs in Minnesota, our skilled nursing and assisted living facilities are 94% serving white Minnesotans. Our ICFs and four-person group homes for people with disabilities, 87% white Minnesotans. And then when it comes to personal care attendants for people with disabilities, it's 57% white and a disproportional number of people of color, especially Black Minnesotans. We wrote our strategic plans somewhere in the middle of COVID in 2020. We have 3 major elements to our strategic plan: our stand for better health, fuller life, and lower cost for Minnesotans working to achieve their highest potential. We're committed to a culture of equity that advances equitable outcomes for communities across the state. And operational excellence, we intend to be nationally ranked as a well-run state agency. Highlights in the plan beyond those 3 statements include rewarding measurable health and life outcomes while managing costs through our managed care contracts. We administer all of the contracting in Minnesota for Minnesota Medicaid and Minnesota Care. And this year, as we start our whole round of procurements with the Metro Children and Family contract that's out now on RFP, we are very much adding a big chunk of the contract award going to people who excel in the social determinants of health and not just health care. As Commissioner Malcolm mentioned, so much of health is determined by social determinants. We've added a great big chunk of social determinants this year to our contracting process. We're working to promote the next iteration of integrated health partnerships, more on what that all means later. We are committed to making Minnesota a friendly state. We want to be sure that people with disabilities and older adults have the opportunity to live and work in integrated settings. This population of people living in Minnesota today prefer integrated settings to congregate care settings. And if they preferred those integrated settings before COVID, after reading about COVID, they're certainly going to be interested in integrated settings going forward. And we're committed to making those services available. We're working to integrate services for substance use disorder, mental health, and housing, which are all interrelated. Supporting family preservation and reducing disparities in out-of-home placement of children and increasing access to affordable quality childcare. We've also asked our senior leaders to imagine their biggest possibilities. If over the next 3 years, the biggest thing you can imagine could happen, what would that be? Our Community Supports Administration would incorporate class standards, culturally, linguistically appropriate service standards, into policies and procedures to improve quality and access to service among BIPOC communities. The IChirp model would be a standard of care for all African American and American Indian women served by our healthcare plans, helping them to have healthier lives as women, as moms, and for their babies. We would drive down disproportionality for African American and Native American children and families in child protection. And inside DHS, our employees would feel valued for raising compliance and ethics concerns and working collaboratively to make systemic changes that support our integrity as an agency. Starting with our healthcare administration, where we have 716 employees, it says all funds is $125 million. That's how much they spend on many of their programs and services. But if you include the health contracts that they administer, that's $14 billion as they go to administer our medical assistance and Minnesota care programs.
Commissioner, we have a question, I think, from Representative Ryer. I don't know, Representative Ryer, do you need to ask it now or should we let the commissioner zip through the rest?
Oh, absolutely can wait. Thank you, Madam Chair. Can absolutely wait. Just getting my place in queue.
Okay, and this gives me a good moment to say, Commissioner, I'm really so sorry we have to do this to you, but we are ending our hearing at 4:30, so we're pretty squeezed.
Okay. Okay, so this year our healthcare administration has been very busy supporting the COVID response, especially making sure that people had their healthcare uninterrupted throughout the pandemic. And of course, supporting all of the what we call tele-everything that we learned about during COVID. We're concerned about the potential Supreme Court decision regarding the Affordable Care Act and what it would do to our health programs in Minnesota. Next slide. Our operations have 753 employees, and their major programs are the Office of Inspector General, which includes our licensing and fraud investigation and background studies divisions, our compliance office, our financial office, and human resources. The operations opportunities and challenges include Operation Swiss Watch, which we put in place to button up our process controls after overpayments were discovered a couple of years ago. COVID modifications, background studies, program integrity, and the Family Child Task Force recommendations. You can see our budget here, 53% federal, 34% state general fund, and some smaller funds that we also access. We just like to show you that 3% of our money is spent on administration. Somebody mentioned appropriate administrative costs earlier. 97% flows straight through us to programs and services.
Thank you, Commissioner.
You're welcome. In our forecasted programs, you can see the first five are coming right, or the first four are coming straight through our medical assistance healthcare program. And here I would like you to notice, if you add the first very long bar and the third one, which is also elder and disabled basic care, you see, if you put them together on one very long line, you would see how much we invest in long-term care and supports for older adults and people with disabilities, which would leave the rest of these bars what we spend on children and families. Medical assistance covers more children than adults, but most of the money is spent on the elderly and disabled. And this is just a split out by fund. You can see federal, state, our healthcare access fund, and local county shares. Again, in our healthcare area, we are committed to better health, fuller life, lower cost. We are moving forward with new procurement system, new procurement processes to include more social determinants of health. And we were very pleased when the Department of Health was completely distracted by COVID that we continued to chair the meetings of the Blue Ribbon Commission in time to bring cost-saving strategies to the tune of $100 million for your consideration in this session. In terms of COVID, we implemented all kinds of waivers of rules and regulations to allow people to continue to work during COVID. We did not interrupt our process control improvements for the pandemic. We were able to keep those going. It gave us an unprecedented opportunity to run every one of our COVID waivers through our policy review committee. So every assistant commissioner who wanted to waive rules saw us modeling firsthand, crossing all the T's and dotting all the I's before approving waivers, checking for legal, financial, and CMS implications before saying yes. My greatest learning in my first year as commissioner is the discovery of who gets heard in state government. If I don't proactively reach out to BIPOC, LGBTQIA communities, people with disabilities, rural communities, the people I hear from are the organizations who can afford the advocates, lobbyists, professional associations, and public relations campaigns, no surprise to our legislators. In other words, the largest, most well-resourced organizations. And we need to take this learning into the deepest levels of DHS to be sure we're equitably distributing that $17 billion of state and federal resources we have responsibility to make available to all Minnesotans. That's my presentation.
Oh, that's wonderful, Commissioner. Thank you very much. And I just, before I go to our people with questions, I just want to kind of put another emphasis on that last slide of the commissioners that we in the legislature, you know, it's only a real segment of our population that reaches out to us, that knows how to get a hold of us, that has the resources and the knowledge. And sometimes that causes us to miss the people who don't have that knowledge and so on and are not represented by those lobbyists who oftentimes bring wonderful help and resources to us, but they may not represent everybody who should be at the table. So I think it's a really important point. Okay, I'm going to go to Representative Ryer, then Quam, then Grunhagen. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. First of all, I have so much appreciation for what your agency does and the scope of it. I've had some involvement with Human Services, including a year of, as an evaluator at Ramsey County Human Services. So I got a little bit close to the type of work you do. I just want to tell you how much I respect and appreciate it. And I love your emphasis on diversity and on expanding your own perspective and point of view. So with that, I just had an observation that when I was looking at the slide deck in advance, and I had it printed on two per page. There was one, so on pages 9 and 10, we go from Minnesota excels in human services to Minnesota's disparity in outcomes. And I put on my community of color hat, which I can only borrow. I am a white woman. And I thought, we excel, but we don't. It had a kind of a whatever. And I just wanted to raise that because I think building trust between the dominant community and the communities of color depends on these small nuances. I wanted to raise that at the same time as I thank you for your commitment to focusing on those things, because that's how we're going to address the disparities. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I noticed there's some geospatial presentations, but they've been aggregated by counties. If you disassociate that and you have it overlaid, we can also try and see if proximity to clinics, proximity to transit options, proximity to, or, you know, areas where you've got non-emergency medical transit. That might help clear up causes, effects, and components of the equation of, disparities by groups. And then you can have other factors where you could highlight and unhighlight, so you could separate subsets by, employment, economic, and it might really show that there are more environmental, as in accessibility by public transportation or accessibility by certain types of healthcare facilities that can help us plan on more effectively and efficiently providing access. And so offline, it might be nice to have a short conversation with your geeky people and see what we might be able to come up to assist us in doing our job. Thank you.
Chair Liebling, if I might, and
please.
Representative, several learnings during COVID. The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe discovered that they had a very high no-show rate for behavioral health appointments before COVID. And as a result of our ability to do telehealth with behavioral health, they reduced that from 40% to 10%. And we discovered that some of that is, and I've always known that in the behavioral health field, sometimes the behavioral health issue that someone's struggling with is what keeps them from making their appointment. When you simply pick up the phone and there's your counselor and off you go, fewer people miss appointments. The other thing is there were transportation issues in the area. And so I think we delivered more behavioral health per week during COVID than we did before COVID, because it was so easy to just pick up the phone and have those meetings when that worked for people. That doesn't work for everyone. Of course, we also discovered the disparity in broadband access. And so it was one thing to say, well, let's just have a Zoom meeting, but not everyone in Minnesota can access that reliably. And so that's a disparity we learned about as well. So I really appreciate your comments. We were also really thrilled last week to open, well, it was opened before the first, but we celebrated the opening last week of a new dental clinic in Fergus Falls that we opened in partnership with Appletree Dental. And we discussed with the press and the local community at the time that many people in that part of the state drive an hour to reach the nearest dentist, even if they have full dental coverage. So yes, lots of disparities in Minnesota based on access and transportation.
Madam Chair, just quickly,
if
there are a few of us on our the committee that could try and work offline, we've got huge amounts of data out there, but having it presented in the right form might be useful. And so I would volunteer to participate in that offline effort.
Okay, thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation. Yeah, I think you heard my question from before you were online. Like the low reimbursement on Medicaid, in dental, it's been a problem. You kind of just acknowledged that. I think we're one of the lowest in the nation, 48th or 49th or something. That's based off memory. But do you think the disparities problem that we have in terms of healthcare is aggravated or partly due to the lower reimbursement on Medicaid, where doctors and hospitals generally lose money on the reimbursement rate?
Yes.
Commissioner.
Yes.
Okay. What can we do about that?
Chair Liebling and Representative Paymore?
So part of the problem we have with the disparities is that low reimbursement rate, because it becomes more of a widget making situation, healthcare, rather than, traditional healthcare, where the doctor isn't under pressure to push more people through. And I know a lot of HMOs, even on the individual side, are putting pressures on doctor to push patients through because of the reimbursement. Any comments?
Chair Liebling and Representative, I have one example that just came up, and that is that the federal government has announced that they're paying almost twice as much for vaccine reimbursement for Medicare as they are for Medicaid. And we're very concerned about the equitable distribution of those vaccines based on the differential in reimbursement. So we'll be talking to Chair Liebling about possibly supplementing that to be sure we eliminate that market disparity.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative Grunhagen. We have Representative Hewitt.
Real quickly, and this might be more, Madam Chair, Commissioner, and real quickly, this might be more of a statement or maybe something you can answer real quick, but it's my belief and what I've experienced back as a provider that because of Minnesota being a higher reimbursement rate for Medicaid, because we do have the provider tax in place, we do find that providers do tend to go over here versus like our neighboring states, Wisconsin, who really do struggle with a very low provider reimbursement rate. Is that correct?
Commissioner?
Chair Liebling and Representative, I would have to go check more. I don't know as much as I should about differential Medicaid rates across state lines. I think Representative Grunhagen and I happen to both be focused on dental in the moment as we were talking, and we have a very low dental rate in Minnesota. But in terms of our Medicaid rates for other health services, I would have to check, but I trust that you know about that. In terms of other states, even near us, having even lower rates.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. And I just would like to comment on Representative Grunhagen's question is that the data I've seen is that even when you control for issues or economic education, that there are still disparities, and I would just call out Serena Williams as an example. That said, of course, the other factors that you're talking about are important, but I just want to keep the other more structural, non-financial disparities on the table. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Representative Ryer. Well, this just, members, this little brief discussion just gives you a taste of some of the big issues that we will probably be grappling with, and they are hard to solve, and especially because, of course, we're expecting that we're going to have a budget deficit this year, and so we're going to have to be setting a budget that, although we don't know, let's face it, we do not know, but we will be looking for savings, and so when it's very easy to find places where more investment would really be wonderful. And I just would challenge members as to start thinking about ways that we can find savings that don't hurt people. That's going to be our challenge, or it may be our challenge. I hope that that's not the situation that we're in. But So we're going to be talking tomorrow a little bit more about what's happened financially during the COVID pandemic, and then also in terms of just talking about outcomes here, we do have something called Results First in the state that focuses on outcomes, and we're going to be having a presentation from that organization too. It lives in MMB. And can perhaps be helpful to us because one of the things that we always want to be doing, whether we have a budget deficit or not, is trying to do more of the things that work and less of the things that don't work. And the question is always, how do you know what works and how do you know what doesn't work? And so that's what Results First attempts to help us with. So, Commissioner, thank you very much for your presentation. And I know you did it in super quick time, and it's an enormous agency with all kinds of issues that you could talk about, and we hope to have you back many times over the course of the session, and thank you very much for your participation. I don't see any other questions, and it being the time for our adjournment, so until tomorrow, we are adjourned. Thank you.